This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. When Isabel Allende wrote her first novel, The House of the Spirits, she was living in exile in Venezuela. She had moved there with her family after the 1973 military coup in Chile, in which her uncle, then president of the country, died under suspicious circumstances. Since then, Allende has never stopped writing. Considered one of Latin America's greatest authors, she is perhaps best known as a novelist. Her latest book, The Sum of Our Days, is a sequel to Paula, a memoir written about her daughter, who was only 28 when she died from an enzyme disorder. Isabel Allende joins us now to talk about her new book.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You know, as I mentioned, The Sum of Our Days is a sequel to your memoir, Paula, and it begins with your family scattering Paula's ashes in the forest. And I wondered, as I read that, how difficult it was for you to return to that difficult time and that personal territory again in your writing.
It wasn't difficult at all. I had other difficulties, but not remembering and not the emotions. I write a letter to my mother every day, and so all the events are very fresh for me. When I was writing this memoir, I just went through the letters, and I could remember everything very neat and very clearly because of the letters. And the emotional part wasn't hard either, because many years have gone by, and I have learned to live with the spirit of my daughter in such a wonderful and comfortable way that I miss her, of course. I would love to have her alive and I could talk to her, but she's in my heart.
And you do talk to her all the time in this book and,
yeah,
and,
I do.
And in your life
but
as
in
well.
Real life, in real life I do. I'm sitting in the car and I'm driving in the traffic jam and I'm talking to her.
Well, I love this idea that you talk to your daughter all the time and you write letters to your mother all the time. What an incredible connection you have there.
Well, before, when my daughter was alive, the three of us, my mother, she and I, would write and send copies of the letters to each other. So there was this strange, ongoing conversation that never stopped.
Well, I wanted to ask you about spirituality, because I have a sense from this memoir, too, that the spirit is very important to you.
For example, in the case of my daughter, I have never seen her ghost, but she's so present in my memory that it is as if her spirit would be with me all the time. Now, what's the difference? Is this a real spirit or is it just my memory? For practical effect, it's the same. And I allow in my life the possibility of unexplainable things to happen, like premonitions, dreams that are very powerful and that somehow clear the way for a lot of stuff, especially the writing. So why stick to what we think is real? We think that reality is what we can control. That's reality. But there's a lot that we can't explain or control that also happens in many levels. And I'm interested in that as a writer and as a woman.
Well, this book is so much about your family and your friends, and you call them your tribe. How are they a tribe?
They are a tribe because we are not blood related. We have come to be together because we have things in common and we love each other. And we have made the decision to live in this sort of emotional compound. We all live more or less in the same neighborhood, a few minutes away from each other. We share food, we share clothes, we share children. We help each other, very much the way I grew up. And it's rare nowadays to have something like that in a city. It still happens in the countryside maybe, but in cities it's hard. And we have created this wonderful thing. And the book was published already in Europe, in Spain, Italy, and Portugal. And I'm getting hundreds of letters from people who have a nostalgic feeling for community, for family. So I see that there's that need that I always had, but I see that other people have it too.
Why are women so important to you? So much of this tribe is about the women who have helped you get through some tough times.
Women have been important in my life emotionally and in many, many other ways. And I've been working with women and for women all my life, so I know them so well. And in this tribe that we have in California, women are really important because we manage the tribe somehow. I think that every woman should have a circle of women and meet regularly, share their lives, be in touch. There's nothing so comforting and so wonderful as your women friends.
And you mentioned, too, that you had to create this. This didn't just happen.
Oh, no, it didn't happen. I came here because I fell in lust with a guy, and I'm still with a guy. But he didn't have much of a family, and I didn't know anybody. I didn't even speak English. So it was very hard at the beginning to feel at home. I didn't feel at home for many, many years. And then slowly my son came, my grandchildren were born here, friends came around us, and we created this little nest.
And his family, his children, his grandchild, they are also part of this tribe.
He had a very, very problematic family. His three biological children were drug addicts. So it was very hard to form a family with them because they were not around. And actually, his daughter died a year after my daughter died. So it was a very hard time for us as a couple. But we've overcome a lot. And slowly, these kids are getting better and coming back to the family.
I wanted to ask you about writing and the difference between writing fiction and memoir, because, of course, you first became famous as a novelist, and now your memoirs, of course, have also become very well read. Which is more difficult for you?
Memoir. I can write fiction because I'm allowed to lie as much as I want. Nobody's checking. But when I write a memoir, the people I talk about, I know I don't talk about myself only. I'm part of a group. So the other people have other versions of how things happened. Everybody wants to look good, and it's hard. My mind works like the mind of a storyteller. I want the highlights, the lowlights. I want the tension, the rhythm, the tragic. That's what interests me. But lives are not like that. And so, for example, my daughter-in-law's infertility problems, I see only the highlights. I don't see much of what went into her soul, all the trauma to her body and all that. So when we talked after the book was written, I realized how much I had missed.
You once said, writing is a silent introspection, a journey into the dark caverns of memory and the soul. Fiction, like memory and dreams, moves from revelation to revelation. I imagine that does not happen with memoir, but it happens in the
writing.
It does happen with memoir as well.
It does, because you work with memory, and as you remember, you connect things. And then you go deeper and deeper into layers of truth. You make these connections, and it's like going into caverns of the soul. Hmm. And you know more about yourself and other people. Memory is a very tricky thing, very tricky.
Let me just ask you one other thing. You've had such an amazing life, you've experienced a lot of tragedy in your life. What would you say now, what brings you the greatest joy now?
Love. The love I have for my children, for my work, for my husband, for my dog, for my friends, for nature, for causes. I'm in love with certain causes that make me feel alive and useful in a way and connected. All that is important to me.
And that's what this book is about, really.
It's about love and about family and friendship and relationships and crazy people and stories. I collect stories. That's what's interesting about my family, that they are all crazy, so it's so easy to write about them. You need a weird family to be a writer. They say exactly the contrary. The family says that it's too bad that they have a writer in the family. Because there are no secrets, you know?
Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Writer and storyteller Isabel Allende, her new book is The Sum of Our Days. Go to npr.org/books, where you can read an excerpt about the day Isabel Allende scattered her daughter Paula's ashes.
Knock'em Stiff is tough stuff. To describe the stories in this book as gritty is a bit like calling Antarctica chilly. Knock'em Stiff, by the way, is a real town in southern Ohio where the author, Donald Ray Pollock, grew up. Characters in his stories beat each other out of boredom, drink themselves into stupors, soil themselves, and assault their neighbors. As one character, Big Bernie Givens, puts it, "I'm 56 years old and sloppy fat and stuck in southern Ohio like the smile on a dead clown's gluteus maximus." And he didn't say gluteus maximus. Knock'em Stiff is the first collection of stories published by Donald Pollock, who worked in a shoe factory, then a paper plant for 32 years, married three times, was in rehab four times, finally left his job at the mill to become a writer. And now he has Donald Ray Pollack joins us from the studios of KPLU in Seattle. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Nakam Stiff is an actual place, but these aren't the people you grew up with. You take some pains to say that.
Most of the people around where I live know where Nakam Stiff is, so I wanted to make sure that they didn't think that it was a nonfiction memoir or anything like that.
Well, on the contrary, you say the people you grew up with were very nice.
For the most part, they were, yes.
I want to give people some idea of your prose style, and I wonder if I could get you to read the opening of your story, Hare's Fate.
Sure. When people in town said inbred, what they really meant was lonely. Daniel liked to pretend that anyway. He needed the long hair. Without it, he was nothing but a creepy country stooge from Nakam Stiff, Ohio. Old people glasses, and acne sprouts, and a bony chicken chest. You ever try to be someone like that? When you're 14, it's worse than being dead. And so, when the old man sawed off Daniel's hair with a butcher knife, the same one his mom used to slice rings of red bologna and scrape the pig's jowl, he might as well have cut the boy's ugly head off, too.
I'm struck by something you say later in the story about this character, Daniel. You say he never had anything to celebrate, not once in his whole life.
Yes.
Is that true of a lot of the characters here?
A lot of the characters live pretty trapped lives. You know, they're caught in a place where they don't particularly want to be in. But at the same time, they just find it too hard to escape.
We want to talk about your history. Because let's put it this way, you come to the craft of being a writer with a whole lot more life experience than certainly the 24-year-old graduate students at the Writers' Workshop in Iowa who come out of Princeton and go there.
Yeah.
But when you were 12, 13, 14, 17, or 18, did you think about being a writer?
Sure. I always read a lot. Now, there wasn't a lot of books in the home or anything like that, but probably by the time I was a freshman in high school, I'd pretty much read everything in the small library we had at the school. And I always thought, you know, maybe that would be a nice way to get along in the world, you know, to be a writer, but I never really had the discipline or the wherewithal to try until I was about 45 years old.
What happened?
I just realized that if I ever wanted to do anything else with my life, I was going to have to try now. And so I told my wife that I would give it 5 years and see what happened. And at the end of the 5 years, I had published maybe four stories and been accepted to the MFA program at Ohio State.
You worked 32 years in a paper plant, right?
Yes.
What kind of work?
Well, it was all factory work, of course. I wasn't in management or anything. And the last 18 years that I was there, I worked in the power plant and took care of the ash coal silos. You know, I kept them empty, drove a truck, pretty much just all labor.
Did you let your mind wander? Were you salting away stories?
Well, yes. I mean, after I got used to the job, it was pretty easy to daydream. So I think some of the ideas probably came from while I was driving the truck.
Well, what's the process of writing like for you?
Once I could get the first line of the story and a voice in my head, the writing, I won't say it came easily, but I could always get something. Once I got a voice in my head where, you know, I had this person talking to me, and then a lot of revision.
I want to give people some idea of the quality of the opening line you have in stories. Almost at random, the story back teen begins, I'd been staying out around Massaville with my crippled uncle because I was broke and unwanted everywhere else, and I spent most of my days changing his slop bucket and sticking fresh cigarettes in his smoke hole. Wow, what a beginning.
Yeah, that was a good one. I think readers are so impatient that if you don't get them with the first sentence or two, you've probably lost them, you know, a lot of times.
We mentioned that you'd been married three times, right?
Yes.
Which is, I'm sorry if this is intrusive, but the wife who agreed that you've got to try it now, sweetheart, 5 years to be a writer, is that the woman to whom you're still married?
Yes, it is. I'm still married to her, and we're doing well.
What were those 5 years like? There must have been some anxiety.
I didn't have a lot of expectations. Mm-hmm. And so when I started out, I also didn't know too much about how to begin. And so I would type out stories that I liked on a typewriter.
You mean type other stories out?
Yes, type other writers' stories. Right. You know, I'd never been in a writing workshop or anything, and I, you know, it just seemed to be a way to get closer to figuring out how other writers did what they did. So I did that quite a bit.
What stories do you remember?
Several from Dennis Johnson's Jesus' Son, quite a few Hemingway stories, some Flannery O'Connor, mm-hmm. Barry Hanna stories, John Cheever, Richard Yates. I tried quite a few different writers.
What would you learn by typing?
I think one of the principal things I learned from typing the stories out was how dialogue works. Also, just, you know, things about structure. And, you know, I could read a story, but I really wouldn't see how it worked until I got closer to it.
Is there something to be said for waiting until you're pushing 50 to start writing?
Well, I think for me, working all those years in the paper mill and being around all of those blue-collar people, you know, union workers and, you know, even being married a couple times, all that kind of stuff, it helps as far as, you know, having a lot of life experience. You know, I've got a lot of stories that I think I could tell if I can just put them down on paper.
Mr. Pollack, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Scott. It's been a pleasure talking to you, too.
In Seattle, Donald Ray Pollack, his new book, his first, is Knock'em Stiff. And you can read an excerpt from Donald Ray Pollack's story, Real Life, on our website, npr.org/books. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Some of the nation's amateur cooks have a shot at a $1 million prize this weekend at the Pillsbury Bake Off.
You would think you'd see people elbowing each other's eggs off the kitchen counter and, you know, some kind of sabotage, throwing a little hot pepper in the chocolate cake. But it's quite the opposite of that.
Ellie Matthews speaks from experience. 10 years ago, a recipe for salsa couscous chicken won the grand prize at the Bake Off. As it begins again, she's published a memoir about the experience called The Ungarnished Truth. Talk us through that process. You start, I suppose, one person alone in a kitchen. What's your ambition and what do you do first?
Well, for me, it involves a fair amount of experimentation and just trying to dream up what could I do with a can of biscuits that nobody ever did before. I mean, for example, you know the kind of biscuits I'm talking about that come in a paper tube and whap it against the counter and they all burst out. I boiled some. And before you laugh out loud, let me say bagels are boiled before they're baked and pretzels are boiled before they're baked. And I thought it might be a good idea, but don't try it.
But it's good that you were brave enough to take that step.
Well, I don't know how much bravery it takes to put out 89 cents on a can of something and try it. I mean, nobody's around to see me have a bad idea. But anyway, after that, when there is something that seems to come together and make something that you'd want to put on a plate and serve to someone, write it up, send it in, let the judging begin.
Well, I suppose we should emphasize that you talk about dealing with a tube of biscuits or some chicken breasts or whatever else. You're not thinking in terms of reaching for the rarest Tasmanian root that's going to create a flavor that no one has ever tasted before.
Well, some people do. And each contest seems to have its own culture. For the Pillsbury Bake Off, I think we would not want that Tasmanian root.
It sounds like you prefer to work with what you've got.
Well, I typically buy ingredients that look good and wrestle them into a pan and serve a meal. I don't do a lot. I'm not a fussy cook. I don't put 4 different kinds of sea salt into something or 18 different kinds of vinegar or whatever. I wouldn't say I'm a plain cook, but I'm fairly practical.
I want to flip here to the recipe that won. And I do want to emphasize again the simplicity of this. It's 3 short paragraphs. You got a skillet, you got some garlic, you got some chicken thighs, you got some salsa, cinnamon, honey, currants, cumin, and water. That's about it.
There we go. The idea was to take the Mexican assumption of salsa and grab it by the throat and carry it across the globe to Morocco.
So you were one of thousands and thousands of people across the country submitting these recipes. Judges sift through them. You find out you're one of 100 finalists. And what happens then?
At the time, I lived in Seattle, so what it meant for me to become a finalist in the contest that year is that I'd be flown to Orlando, where we'd all be gathering in a huge hotel and making the recipes 3 times, once for the judges, once for display, and then optionally the 3rd time if we wanted to pass out samples. And we started cooking at 9 in the morning, and one person's making something ooey-gooey with chocolate, and someone else has garlic sautéing in olive oil. And the blend of aromas was staggering.
Did you look over at the next table and think, oh, no, I should have thought of that, or, uh-oh, I have no chance now?
When I was cooking, I wasn't thinking about my chances of winning. I went to the contest with the idea of being in training so I could see how it worked, so I could get an inside look at what the operation amounted to, so I could go back another time and enter in earnest. And in fact, at the winning moment, believe it or not, in the millisecond of awareness that I'd risen to the top, one of my thoughts was, oh no, I can't come back. I knew I had been disqualified by virtue of winning the grand prize.
Wait, this is a practice run. Take back your $1 million. I'm having
exactly.
too much fun.
Well, I wasn't quite thinking in such rational terms.
Do you mind if we play a bit of tape of that moment, the winning moment here? And I guess we're going to hear the voice of Alex Trebek, the famous game show
yes.
host, master
yes.
of ceremonies at the Pillsbury Bake Off some time ago.
Ladies and gentlemen, the 1998 Pillsbury Bake Off $1 million grand prize winning recipe is the Salsa Couscous Chicken. Ellie Matthews of Seattle, Washington. Come out here.
Wow. That must have been pretty
wow.
exciting.
Well, when I saw that I had won, and the way they announce it is to show the winning dish mm-hmm. And lift a big silver dome up, and the winning dish is under the dome. And my first thought was, they've made a mistake. And one of the Pillsbury people will come out on stage and say, we're terribly sorry, but we put the wrong thing under there.
Wasn't true. Wasn't true.
And I also felt a little bit embarrassed because I wasn't sure that I had earned it. I had made mistakes in the recipe. I hadn't called for a garnish, and garnishing and how you plate the food is a big part of the judging. And I meant to say boneless, skinless thighs, and I failed to say boneless.
You keep saying you failed. I'm not sure I can think of another contest winner who's used the word failed in reference to themselves.
Oh, dear. Oh, I'm supposed to. Someone has said I shouldn't be so self-deprecating, but it just seems to be my natural mode. I mean, I don't think I have any claim on being a better cook than anybody else. I like to cook, and I'm not afraid to try things. I don't think winning this contest establishes me as anything when it just comes to me and putting a meal together at home.
Well, Ellie Matthews, author of The Ungarnished Truth, I have to tell you, I'm hungry. So I'm going to go. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
And before I run off, let me just mention that you can hear what Ellie Matthews did with her prize money and get her recipe for salsa couscous chicken at NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Lois Lowry is a writer of young adult fiction and a 2-time Newbery Award winner. Her books tackle serious, thought-provoking issues. Her most famous work, The Giver, chronicles the dark underbelly of a future utopian society. Here's her pick for our reading series, You Must Read This.
One spring bedtime in 1945, my mother opened a book and began to read aloud to me the first chapter of The Yearling by Marjorie Kennan Rawlings. I was 8 years old. By eight, I already knew I wanted to be a writer. I had taught myself to type on my father's Royal Portable Typewriter, and I had read the children's classics of the time, The Secret Garden, Little Women. I pictured myself growing up to write about characters like these, smart, independent girls who rise above their circumstances, girls who triumph. Then, as my mother read those first few pages of The Yearling, I saw blue-gray smoke rising from the chimney of a simple cabin, and watching the smoke drift into the sky was a boy named Jody Baxter. I recognized him right away. He was so like me, skinny, blonde, solitary. I moved, as my mother read the words, into the clearing in the Florida swampland where the Baxters lived their hardscrabble lives. I could hear the insects buzzing and the bubbling sound of the little spring, and I could see the glisten of the dark magnolia leaves and smell the thick pines. It was the first time I had slid so effortlessly into the landscape of a novel. But I was jolted, too, in the first pages by the bleakness, the desperate poverty, Jody's grim, defeated mother. These were people who were probably never going to rise, never going to triumph. Our volume of The Yearling contained illustrations, paintings by N.C. Wyeth. One showed the boy, Jody, seated on the floor leaning against his father's bed as the father fights for life after having been bitten by a rattlesnake. My mother showed me the picture. We gazed at it together for a long time, and then she went on to finish the chapter. The concluding words, speaking about the boy, are, "He was torn with hate for all death and pity for all aloneness." When she read that sentence, my mother began to cry. It was only as an adult looking back on that moment that I realized she had been weeping for herself. Her husband, my father, was in the Pacific then, where terrible battles were still being fought during that spring, late in the war. My mother must have been as frightened and lonely as the boy in the book. Jody Baxter didn't triumph. No wealthy uncle, no neighborly benefactor, no pious platitudes at the end. But when I moved into his world, I fit more comfortably there than I ever had in the lush English gardens of Mary Lennox, or the virtuous New England of Joe March. A writer is often a lonely person. Our worlds are populated by the things we imagine, the things we remember or dream. For me, the voice of childhood is the one I hear most clearly. It comes to me in the cadence and diction of The Boy in The Yearling, a book I return to again and again.
Lois Lowry is a 2-time winner of the Newbery Award. She's the author of The Giver. Her most recent work is The Willoughbys. You can find more You Must Read This recommendations at our website, npr.org/books.
We've been hearing two words in this year's election, change and experience. You may not get both in the candidates, but you do in Sapphire's Political Dictionary. This guide to the uses and abuses of political language in America has gotten its first update in 15 years. Of course, in his New York Times column on language, William Sapphire offers a weekly exegesis of emerging words and expressions, many of them arising from the world of politics. And we reached him at his office in Washington, D.C., and thank you for joining us.
Greetings, Renee.
Now, let me put you on the spot. What is the best new word or phrase?
Well, the trouble with that is it takes a couple of months to get a book out. And as soon as you get a dictionary out, wham, new words come flying in. And I'm sitting here making notes already for the next edition.
Well, you could tell us the best new word that didn't get into the dictionary.
All right, well, you just mentioned the word change. That's a word that it was used strongly in the Lincoln era when they took a famous phrase, don't change horses in the middle of the stream to support Abe Lincoln against General McClellan. And the counter shot was change horses or drown.
Well, you do actually have changing horses there, although what you say is C, don't change horses. You actually do that throughout the book with certain words. For instance, I looked up the word oxymoron. You don't define it. You say C, loyal opposition, splendid misery.
Well, sometimes a good way to define something is to point out how it's used. When you say an oxymoron, which is the juxtaposition of seemingly contradictory words, I go for the uses of them in politics, like, as you point out, loyal opposition.
What then does distinguish political language from plain ordinary language? I mean, so many of your words and phrases seem to contain an initial definition and then its opposite. For instance, fact-finding trip.
Well, a fact-finding trip leads to a truth squad that usually shoots holes in the fact-finding trip. What the political language looks for is word pictures. For example, when somebody leaves under a cloud, that's been used so often that it lost its punch. But when you say someone leaves in a hail of dead cats, all of a sudden that'll wake somebody up, and a vivid metaphor can make a speech and also can make a charge.
Well, the word alliteration, you define that word as the careful culling of consonants to pack a punch in politics.
I kind of like alliteration, and when I was a speechwriter, I came up with one because Dwight Eisenhower had used prophets of gloom and doom to attack defeatists. And so I came up with nattering nabobs of negativism.
Whoa, I was just thinking of that one. I didn't realize that you originated that expression.
Well, I did, and of course, I did it for Spiro T. Agnew.
Yeah, and, Vice President under Nixon.
Right, and the code of the speechwriters is you never claim a phrase. But the Vice President did say, I got that from Sapphire, and it was either that or the hopeless hysterical hypochondriacs of history, and he went with the better one.
Well, for those who might not have been around to have heard that, because it was a big phrase in its moment. It was back in the early 70s.
I used it to describe defeatists in the Vietnam War days. Then it was applied after that to the press, to the media.
You were known, and I think you'd embrace this as a conservative, with any number of words, you make what amounts to a political choice about how you define them. It doesn't seem to fall on either the liberal or the conservative end. For example, the word waterboarding, you define it straightforwardly as a form of torture.
Absolutely, because one thing I knocked myself out in this dictionary, and I've been writing it for 40 years, is to set aside the fact that I'm a vituperative right-winger and nut, as many have suggested. But when I put on my lexicographic hat, the dictionary writer, I try to work it right down the middle. And I've been scrupulous about that. I think somebody who turns to a dictionary should get it straight and bipartisan.
One word in this dictionary someone might look up, macaca, a word that a lot of people learned even existed just a couple of years ago when Republican Senator George Allen was transformed into former Republican senator after he used that word. You don't define macaca. You send us readers directly to the word blooper.
Right, because bloopers cover the whole field of toe stubbings and misspeakings. Now, there are minor bloopers, like slips of the tongue, when President Bush said, I'm misunderestimated. That's obviously a redundancy. But he realized that that was being used to poke fun at him, so he's used it again occasionally in a kind of an ironic, self-kidding way. And in the cut and thrust of politics, words are tossed out and invite us to say, hey, wait a minute, now exactly what does that mean? And that's the function of a dictionary.
Do you think our world has changed with the rise of cable TV and...
That's a good point. The blogosphere has had a terrific impact on spreading hot new words, and it's difficult to tell sometimes whether it's a nonce term, one that comes and goes, or it clings, it gets spread around, and before long it becomes part of the language. Or it comes back from a long time ago. We're all talking about, will there be a deal made at the Democratic Convention? And I saw John Meacham of Newsweek saying it could be a corrupt bargain. And that immediately hearkened you to the 1824 convention when Henry Clay got together with John Quincy Adams and they joined forces and defeated Andrew Jackson. And as a result, Clay became the Secretary of State in what was called then a corrupt bargain. So we've reached back in history, pull that phrase out, and believe me, if they try to make a deal in Denver or Minneapolis, if the Republicans ever want to compete there, whatever deal is made will be denounced as a corrupt bargain. And those who have read this dictionary will immediately smile knowledgeably and say, I know where that came from.
William Sapphire, thank you for joining us.
Great pleasure.
William Sapphire has just updated his Sapphire's Political Dictionary for the first time in 15 years and just in time for election 2008. And you can find out where Spinmeister came from and more political expressions at NPR.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Mary Roach has written a book about sex, nonfiction. It's about sex research. At this point, you would expect an assurance that this is a serious book, clinical, not comical. And you would be wrong, because it is both clinical and comical. Mary Roach is a solid science journalist with a glorious sense of humor. That's probably why the title of her book is Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. She last talked with us here about her book on cadavers. It was called Stiff. A warning, this interview includes references, mostly sober references, to sex organs and also to polyester. In Bonk, Roach explores the current state and the history of research into human sexuality, and she drafts her husband into service as a study subject with her. She also introduces readers to trailblazers in the field, some of whom I'd heard of, Alfred Kinsey, Masters and Johnson, but there were some I hadn't heard of, like Robert Latou Dickinson, a Brooklyn-based physician.
Robert Latou Dickinson was a phenomenal man. He was a gynecologist working in the 1890s through about the 1930s. He's actually the man who got Kinsey interested in sex. Kinsey had been studying gall wasp speciation, had no inkling of what lay ahead for him, then met this man, Robert Latou Dickinson. In his gynecological practice, Dickinson began asking patients systematically about their sex lives and not, you know, how is it, but what do you do and how do you have an orgasm and how are things going for you? And so he had these detailed case studies, and he began to see that there were a lot of very unhappy and unsatisfied people, and he began going further along and actually started doing some physiological testing. And back then, there wasn't a lot of fancy equipment. So Dr. Dickinson at one point became interested in what exactly goes on inside people when they're having sex, and he used a test tube. He actually inserted it and would shine a light so he could actually see what was going on in there, that if the test tube were standing in for the penis, then you would see, you know, where is it hitting? Is it hitting the cervix? And there was, at the time, it was believed that the penis actually interlocked with the cervix, which is not true, and he could see that, in fact, it wasn't even hitting anywhere near the head of the cervix, and he was able to sort of debunk the coital interlocking theory. So he was really the first man to take a really scientific laboratory approach to figuring out what happens when people have sex.
And he was doing this in the early decades of the 20th century. And he, I mean, do we know if lots of his patients were turning him down and were put off by these questions, or were they all?
As far as I could tell, they were amazingly cooperative. I went into one of the archives where some of his files are, and he kept these detailed note cards with the responses that people were giving him. And they were very, very forthcoming and seemed to have no qualms about it. And this is, I think, actually the 1920s were a surprisingly open-minded and freewheeling era. This was before the 40s and 50s when we swang back the other way. The 1920s, there were sex manuals at the time that were encouraging women to try being on top. They were talking about the clitoris. The 1920s were almost like the 60s in a way. And then we swang back to a more conservative era.
Now, as you said, Dr. Robert Latou Dickinson was the person whose work inspired Alfred Kinsey. In passing, you note, I'm reading a quote now. I give you a sentence, my favorite sentence in the entire oeuvre of Alfred Kinsey from Sexual Behavior in the Human Female. Quote, cheese crumbs spread in front of a copulating pair of rats may distract the female, but not the male.
That's my favorite, yes. He was making the point that the female, the human female he was talking about, is more prone to distraction during sex. He was talking about, in general, the male and the female to a certain extent. When you're very, very aroused, a tremendous amount of stuff can be going on around you and you won't notice. Your peripheral vision kind of cuts out. You don't notice if somebody's, you know, picking your pocket, and prostitutes have used this to great benefit. You don't feel pain nearly as much. Mm-hmm. Something that would be painful otherwise is just sort of registers as a mild tactile stimulation. So anyway, it was in that passage of the book that he mentioned the copulating rats and the cheese crumbs.
One of the more exotic studies that you write about was published in, was it European Urology, by an Egyptian doctor?
Yes. That was my favorite study of all time. Dr. Shafik, he's an extraordinary gentleman in that he funds his own research. He's a surgeon, but he's done a lot of research in the realm, the whole pelvic area. So he's done proctology, urology, andrology, sexology. And I came across him kind of arbitrarily. I found this paper in which he was looking at the effects of polyester fabric on the fertility and incidence of copulation in rats. And
I didn't know that rats wore polyester.
Well, normally they don't, but in Dr. Shafik's lab, he actually outfitted laboratory rats in tiny little polyester trousers. And there's a little diagram in the paper. And this is a legitimate research paper published in a peer-reviewed journal. And there's a line drawing of a rat wearing these tiny little trousers, and on the caption says, the underpant worn by the rat.
I gather Dr. Shafik passed away last year, you told me.
Yes, in October he passed away.
And he found in that particular study that wearing polyester, wearing polyester diminished the fertility of the rats, but you at least admit the possibility that perhaps he was just wearing anything or dressing funny might also diminish the fertility of anyone.
Yes, the incidence of copulations, I think whether you're a rat or a human male wearing those trousers, I mean, you kind of need to see the trousers, but there's a little hole for the tail and they're drawstring at the top and they're not very attractive. And I think it would be kind of hard to get a date in that case, yes.
Well, after meeting people like Dr. Shafik in Cairo and you and your husband taking part in a study with Dr. Deng in London and so many other interviews you report on in the book. I mean, what do you come away? What's the takeaway knowledge you have from having written Bonk?
Well, I think that one of the things that I'm left with is a lingering sense of surprise that there are still a good number of mysteries in the realm of sexual physiology. You kind of have the sense that as a person who has sex, you figure, well, you know, it seems to work. What else do we need to know? Which is kind of a ridiculous attitude. That would be like somebody saying to a person who's studying, say, the esophageal sphincter, well, we all know how to eat. Why do we need to study that? Mm-hmm. So I come up against that all the time. People saying, well, what's the point of this research? You know, tell me something I don't know about sex. We don't know, for example, the mechanisms of ejaculation, what the trigger is for that. And there have been all kinds of elaborate and quite frightening little studies that have been done in that realm. Just any number of things that we really should still be looking into, and yet it's very difficult for sex researchers to get funding for purely anatomical and physiological research these days.
Well, Mary Roach, author of Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
And you can read more about rodents and synthetic clothing, and you can hear Mary give me the scoop on her own experience as an ultrasound imaging guinea pig at our website, npr.org.